Well, one of the things I talked about, okay, let me just kind of set the context here, because we're looking at the last two creation psalms in the Bible, Psalm 147 and 148, and we spent a number of weeks dealing with this passage in verse 4, where God determines the number of stars, calls them each by name. We spent some time actually making the point every star counts of all the 50 billion trillion that God has created to make it possible for us to live here on planet Earth. So when Thanksgiving comes around, you might want to tick off the names of all those stars that God set up there so that we can enjoy fellowship here with one another. But the next portion we're going to go to in Psalm 147 is verses 8 and 9. God covers the sky with clouds. He supplies the earth with rain and makes grass grow on the hills. He provides food for the cattle and for the young ravens when they call. And when you go back to Genesis chapter 1, there's a single sentence which deals with creation day 2, where God talks about how he puts water above and water below, a reference to the water cycle. But what we see in the book of Job, starting in chapter 37 and going on into 38, a little bit into 39, is an extensive passage dealing with this amazing water cycle that God set up. So it actually does provide an abundance of food for all the life that dwells in the kind of the land masses. And what we're going to be looking at in the next few weeks is just going through these texts in the Bible that talk about the water cycle and just recognize the degree to which God has amazingly designed everything. In fact, let me just give you a quick list, which you're going to find in the book of Job. It says, God set the water cycle so that we have dew. We have ice that freezes. We have frosts of different kinds, torrents of rain and showers. It contrasts rain with showers. And probably you've noticed on the Weather Channel that they do that. What's a shower? It's a light rainfall or a mist. That would be called a shower. Rain is what you use for something that's really heavy coming out of the sky. So you remember, you're going to get a quarter of an inch or more of rain. We call it a rain. If it's less than that, we call it showers, or we call it mist. What we see in the book of Job is actually using different words there for the rain and the showers, and talks about torrents of rain as opposed to regular rain. Then it mentions snow, lightning bolts, floods of water, where the land gets flooded with water, where it talks about the surface of the water becoming frozen, referring to lakes that freeze over, hail, and then downpours. Now, what we're going to learn is you need every one of those kinds of events if you're going to have advanced life in the kind of the land masses. If you don't have dew, you're in trouble. If you don't have hail, you're in trouble. If you don't have lakes that freeze over, you're in trouble. If you don't have frost, you're in trouble. If you don't have different kinds of frost. I mean, growing up in Canada, we had all these different names for frost. You know, like a little white frost, and then you got the big, heavy hoar frost. In fact, I've seen frost that is 7 inches high. And what we realize is that's all important if you're having to have grow plants in an area where there isn't a lot of rainfall. You count on that slow melting of that hoar frost to actually cause the land to get the water it needs throughout the day before it all evaporates. So that's just giving a little bit of an idea about what we're going to cover. However, 2 weeks ago, before we did this forum, we finished the whole part on the stars, going to jump into the rain, but then I said, you know, it's an amazing scientific discovery, so hey, I'm going to take a few minutes to try to get you into the discovery we didn't have time for. And what you see here on the chart is the one I talked about in the Skeptics Forum to lead off, how for the first time, we've got an accurate measure of the past temperature of the radiation left over from the cosmic creation event that isn't in the current era. That's that little red dot you see halfway up. Because what we had before were measurements that were consistent with the biblically predicted cooling curve. Remember we talked about how the Bible actually predicts that the universe must get colder and colder as it gets older and older? The Bible tells us that the universe began with a space-time singularity, how all the universe starts off with a beginning of matter, energy, space, and time. Hebrews 11:3, Genesis 1:1, Titus and Timothy all speak about that, and how the universe continuously expands from that beginning under laws of physics that don't change, And Romans 8 tells us that the entire creation is subject to the law of decay. No matter where you go in the universe, we see that everything is subject to the law of decay. And hey, look around you. You can see different individuals that are evidence of the ongoing law of decay, right? We're all living evidence of that. Now, that even applies to those of you who are not yet 20 years of age. Now, if you look carefully at your bodies, you can see little tiny liver spots that are the result of the ongoing process of decay. It starts from the time you're born. And that's the whole point of Romans 8, that everything is subject to this law of decay. Well, we physicists refer to that law of decay as the second law of thermodynamics. And it's that second law that tells us that any system that expands must get colder. And it must get colder in a predictable way. And so what you see there on that chart is what the Bible implies about the past temperature of the universe. How it begins with a space-time singularity. It must start off infinitely or near infinitely hot. If it's expanding under the second law of thermodynamics, it must get colder and colder. The only external point I need to draw that curve outside of the Bible is knowledge of the age of the universe. If I know the age of the universe, then that is the biblically predicted curve. But notice how measurements that astronomers are making of the past temperature of the universe actually fit that curve, and now we can say they perfectly fit the curve. I mean, 3 weeks ago, I would have had to told you they roughly fit the curve. Notice how big those error bars are when you go far back many billions of years. But now we got a measurement 6.4 billion light years away, which means we're looking at the universe as it was 6.4 billion years ago, and it's right exactly on the temperature curve that you get from these passages in the Bible. Yes?
What is CMB?
CMB means cosmic background radiation. Another name for it would be the radiation left over from the cosmic creation event. So at the creation event, the temperature of the universe is infinity or near infinity. And according to the second law of thermodynamics, as the universe expands, it must cool at a particular rate. And you know, we got a very accurate measurement of what it is today, you know, 2.72548 degrees above absolute zero. What's been challenging for astronomers is to get an accurate measure where you're going back significantly in time. And as you can see, we were stuck with error bars that are anywhere from 10 to 30%. Now we get error bars that are below 2%. But now that we've got those tiny error bars, it's perfectly fitting the curve. So it's a dramatic demonstration that what the Bible says about the universe actually is true by measurements. Yes?
I noticed on the graph of Mueller that his billions of years at zero is quite about 2.3 billion years before protons, neutrons, and gluons came together at 10 to the negative 15th, unintended,
right.
15th degree Kelvin. What does he include, and when does
this
begin?
Oh, well, maybe, this may be confusing.
Yeah.
This is the present era. That's not 13.8 billion years ago.
No, I'm talking about
over here is where you're at zero. So yeah, that's where the temperature goes way up to infinity,
but
or near infinity.
He obviously doesn't include his beginning at first matter, which is neutrons, protons, baryons, that 10 to 15.
Right.
So this temperature just goes up to infinity. How does it ever get to zero, and where does he begin this beginning?
Well, what Mueller's team was doing was looking at gas clouds in a distant galaxy where they're looking at spectral lines in that gas cloud that are excited by the radiation left over from the cosmic creation event. So by looking at the strength of those lines, it gave them a measurement of the temperature of the cosmic background radiation 6.4 billion years ago. So from his, if you read the paper, it really says nothing about the conditions of the beginning of the universe.
Well,
he does say, however, that the measurement perfectly fits what's called the cold dark matter Big Bang creation model. So, you know, like all astronomers, he assumes that there's overwhelming evidence for the Big Bang creation model, and says, you know, this temperature is bang on of what that model predicts. So what he was interested in was comparing, say, alternatives to what's called the Big Bang creation model, where the universe is dominated by dark energy and where most of the exotic matter is in a cold state. mean moving at low velocities. Contrasted with a competing model where you would have the exotic dark matter in a warm state or a hot state. And so actually that temperature curve there does assume that most of the exotic matter is in a cold state. Not all of it has to be in a cold state. If you had, for example, 80% cold and 20% warm, you still get the same curve. It doesn't make any difference.
And to get back to the beginning on this graph, the temperature would have to go to billions.
Yes. Or, no, not, you know, billions would be adequate. Whether it's billions or trillions or quadrillions or infinity, you get basically the same graph. That's why I said infinitely hot or near infinitely hot. And by near infinitely hot, anything past, say, a trillion degrees would qualify. You still get the same curve.
Thanks for the definition.
Okay, that's good. And you know, we know it has to be at least a trillion just to explain where we get all the helium in the universe. You won't get helium if the universe starts off, say, only 10 billion degrees.
Well, I'm talking about temperature of the
billion. Yeah, I understand. But what I'm saying is, in terms of this curve here, it really doesn't make any difference whether it's a trillion degrees or infinite temperature. You basically get the same curve.
I think that's why you cut the top of the graph off.
That's why I cut the top of the graph off. Well,
I picked that up right away when you saw the graph.
Well, one reason why that...
Otherwise, I would have needed a much bigger projector to keep on going up.
Yeah, right. But another reason why that's cut off, we can only make these measurements in galaxies. And you don't get galaxies until the universe is about a half billion years old. So yeah, it's pointless to go back any earlier than, say, a half billion. Yes.
Mentioning the second law of thermodynamics. What's the first law?
Well, there's actually three laws of thermodynamics. The first law, basically, a simple way to put it is you can't make anything and you can't get rid of anything. And so that's one of the problems with the second law of thermodynamics. You know, if you could get rid of something or keep something, maybe you can get around it. But what it's saying is nothing can be created, nothing can be destroyed once you get past the cosmic creation event. And so there's a certain stability in the universe, but given that nothing can be created or destroyed, in that context, everything that's there is in a process of decay. That's the second law. So.
Q is important to define that something, obviously, which is energy or matter.
Right.
You know, in the beginning of the universe, we have just energy or just matter. You can convert one to the other, but everything in the universe, God created at the very beginning. I did a story about energy on that and try and impress people.
Right, and it's actually more amazing than that in the sense that the universe starts off without energy or matter, just space curvature.
Right.
And it's the release of space curvature that produces the energy that produces the matter. And what's interesting is you can convert matter back into energy and energy into matter. But once space curvature is released, you can't regain that space curvature. So that again is a principle of the thermodynamics of the universe. Although you can interchange matter and energy, you cannot interchange space curvature and energy. So once space curvature is released, it can never be put back together. So that's an irreversible. That's one of the proofs that the universe really does have a single creation event. The fact that space curvature cannot be reversed. But again, it's a property of the fact that we live in a highly entropic universe. Anyway, this was all covered at the Skeptics Forum, you remember. What I really want to talk about is this paper titled Constraints on Spatial Variations in the Fine Structure Constant from the Planck Satellite. And you all got to go out and read this thing. It's just incredible reading. All right? Especially those of you who love mathematics, you won't be able to put this thing down. So, one of those papers. Okay. Yeah, really, I mean, that's what my wife says. She reads the Astrophysical Journal. This was actually in Astronomy and Astrophysics. It says, you know, they need an English major to help them come up with better titles. It says, no wonder the press never picks up these amazing discoveries. I mean, they look at the title and they forget about it. Well, that's something we ran into in Reasons to Believe, is that we have this feature called Science Newsflash, where we talk about scientific discoveries that everybody knows about. But the problem is that really most exciting discoveries are the things that never make the news. So we're actually thinking maybe developing another podcast where we talk about these. And this would fit into this category. This will never make the news, but it is a stunning discovery. Okay, stunning in what way? Well, Let me give you a little bit of background on this, in that what we see in the Bible is that the heavens declare the glory of God, the heavens declare the righteousness of God. Romans 1 says that we can learn about all the attributes of God by looking at the creation, looking at the universe. Well, one of the things astronomers have discovered is that we human beings are living at a unique time where we actually can observe the heavens. So here's the Bible commanding us to look to the heavens and we'll see his attributes. Well, what if you can't see the heavens? And, you know, we've always taken it for granted that it's a given that we're going to be able to see the heavens. Well, astronomers now know you can't see the heavens unless you're at a particular time in a particular place. Now, as vast as this universe is with 50 billion trillion stars, we're orbiting the one star where we get to see the whole story. I haven't got time to go into the details of that. That's why you should sign up for that class on If God Made the Universe, because one segment actually deals with the fact that we're living in the only location where we get to see the whole story.
They don't have to sign up, they just come.
They just have to come. All right. No money required, just show up, it's free. You even have treats, I heard, so what a deal, okay. But what I will share with you is that, you know, we live on a 10-dimensional universe, 9 dimensions of space, 1 dimension of time. And one reason why we're mapping the cosmic background radiation is to understand the geometry of the universe. But one thing astronomers have discovered is, because of the geometry of the universe, if God put us here any earlier, we would not be able to see the whole history of the universe. In this sense, if we were created earlier, light from the cosmic creation event would not have adequate time to travel on the space surface and reach our telescope. Now, we're here about 13.8 billion years after the cosmic creation event. If God put us here, say, 5 billion years earlier, we'd only be seeing the past two-thirds of the history of the universe. We would not be able to look far enough away. And the principle is this: the farther away you look, the longer it takes light time to reach your telescope. And the amazing thing is, we live in an epoch when we can actually look so far back in time, we're looking at the cosmic creation event itself. We can actually watch God creating the universe in that context. But it also works the other way. If we're created any later, dark energy will be expanding that portion of the space surface of the universe that would represent the look-back time to the beginning of the universe. That would be expanding away from us at greater than the velocity of light. In fact, as we look all the way back 13.8 billion years ago, we're actually measuring an expansion rate for the universe that's barely under the velocity of light. Now, because of dark energy, as more time goes by and the universe gets bigger, the universe expands at a faster and faster rate. So, hey, one way you can celebrate New Year's Day is to celebrate the fact that in the next year, the universe will expand faster than it did in the previous year. I don't know whether you do that. That's something our family makes a habit of doing. But you may have a different tradition for New Year's Eve. So, but it won't be long before the space surface of the universe is expanding at greater than the velocity of light. And when that happens, light from the cosmic creation event will never get to our telescope.
Do we have a date for that event?
Well, that's one reason why the Planck satellite was sent up, so we can measure the geometry of the universe with enough precision that we can narrow that date down. But right now, we don't have an accurate figure for that date. But certainly within a billion years, we're not going to be able to observe what we can observe today. And it may be a narrower time window than that. So that's one question we can't quite answer with any precision. But we do know if we were put here significantly earlier or significantly later, we'd only be seeing part of the storybook of the universe. As it is, we can see the whole book. And God calls the heavens a book. You know, Psalm 19. The heavens declare the glory of God. His words are written upon the heavens for all of us to read. Well, God wanted us to actually be able to read the entire book from the present all the way back to when he created the universe. So one reason why the universe is as old as it is that only at 13.8 billion years after the cosmic creation event can humans observe all of cosmic history and directly witness the cosmic creation event. Just like God wanted us to be able to read the entire Bible, He wanted us to read the entire book of nature. And so we're put here just at that time. Now, you might ask the question, well, it hasn't been very long since we actually been able to have the telescope power to observe the very beginning of the universe. And that's true. And you might say, well, were previous generations cheated? Well, I think previous generations were a lot more in touch with nature than we are today. And I kind of look at this as God knowing ahead of time that we'd all be, or a lot of us would be living in cities, cut off from the realm of nature, and we were going to need other ways for nature to speak to us. And so, this age of technology, we've got God speaking to us in ways that He hasn't before, and it's like God is blessing us who are kind of stuck in these big urban centers and cut off from what farmers took for granted. That's kind of, again, the message of Job 38 and 39, that if you're close to the animals of nature, they will tell you about God. But most people in the world today don't have that message being spoken to them, but they got a different message, a tech message. So God kind of had a separate message for non-techies and for techies. Isn't that good to know? All right. Well, I'm old enough to remember a time when measuring the cosmic background radiation was thought to be an impossible thing to do. In fact, I'll give you a little bit of a background. The Big Bang Theory was discovered by a Belgian monk, Georges Lemaître, back in 1929 and 1930. He was the first one to take Einstein's theory of general relativity and deduce that the universe had to have a beginning and it had to have a Big Bang character. And it was back in George Gamow, back in the late 1930s, who deduced if it's Big Bang, the universe must start off very hot. And then there was a Princeton physicist, very opposed to Big Bang cosmology. Reason why? He was an atheist. And he says, if it's Big Bang, there's a beginning, there's a beginner, that implies God, and it would imply a God like the God we see in the Bible. And he says, I can't accept that. So he came up with an alternate theory. But one of the ways he was trying to critique Big Bang cosmology is he tried to calculate what the temperature of the radiation from a Big Bang creation event would look like to see if he could actually disprove Big Bang cosmology. Well, he calculated back in 1948 that it would be a little bit less than 5 degrees above absolute zero. And on that basis, he said, it'll be impossible to detect it. That's a temperature that's so cold, we'll never have the technology to detect that. Well, move forward to 1963. He had forgotten that he had published this. You know, sometimes that happens to scientists. He completely forgotten he had published this. And he wound up recalculating from scratch what he'd done back in 1948. And determined that the universe would be about 4 degrees or 3 or 4 degrees above absolute zero. And at that time, they had some breakthroughs, mainly because of World War II. What happened in World War II is that they founded this really sophisticated lab at Bell Telephone back in New Jersey. And that's where they invented transistors. They were invented just before the close of World War II to try to get better radar. As one reason why the Allies won the war, they were able to invent transistors. And that had a major impact in bringing about the end of World War II. Well, it was that transistor technology that Robert Dickey realized would enable them to build a receiver that could actually detect a temperature that cold. And so he commissioned a graduate student and several other graduate students. But the guy in charge of the graduate student team was a fellow by the name of Wilkinson. Now, Wilkinson has passed away, but they named the main satellite that's been responsible for giving us insight into the cosmic background radiation after Wilkinson. Anyway, 1963, Wilkinson, a graduate student of Robert Dickey, is building this receiver. They got it mounted on the roof of the physics building at Princeton University. And they're going to try to discover the radiation from the cosmic creation event. And they were hoping they wouldn't find anything, and that would disprove Big Bang cosmology. Well, what happens is Robert Dickey gets a phone call from Bell Labs. And Bell Labs, there's a couple of physicists there. And they had built a receiver, and they had found some radiation through that receiver that they couldn't explain. And for the first little while, they thought it was radiation as a result of pigeon poop. And so there was pigeon poop in their receiver. And so what happened is these two physicists carefully scraped all the pigeon poop off and redid their observations, and the radiation was still there. And they knew that Princeton was interested in this, so they called Robert Dickey and said, "Can you explain what this is?" And Robert said, "You've discovered what we were wanting to look for." He says, "Our receiver is almost finished." It was due to be finished literally within a couple of weeks so they could turn it on and make that discovery. And so what happened is Robert Dickey and Wilkinson published a paper in the same issue of the Astrophysical Journal that I'm trying to think of the two guys' names. Penzias and Wilson at the Bell Labs. So the papers appear side by side in a 1964 edition of the Astrophysical Journal. And as a result, we got Penzias and Wilson winning the Nobel Prize. Now, you might wonder, why is it they never gave the prize to Robert Dickey or to Wilkinson? Well, it's because Robert Dickey, throughout his entire life, was opposed to Big Bang cosmology because of his atheistic worldview. And the astronomers wanted the credit to go to these people who were... Because, you know, Wilson, for example, and Penzias, they were both theists. In fact, I believe that Penzias himself is a Christian. In fact, I quote him in one of my books. And so they got the Nobel Prize, but the astronomical community purposely snubbed Robert Dickey. And, you know, all these years, in spite of his atheism, I thought he really deserved credit for that Nobel Prize because he knew what it was. Wilkinson and Penzias had no idea what they discovered. They had to call Robert Dickey to figure out what they had discovered, and they only beat Dickey's team literally by a couple of weeks. I mean, they were actually building the thing to make the discovery, whereas what was happening at Bell Labs, they just wanted to have a sensitive receiver, and they found this radiation. They had no idea what it was all about. They actually thought it was due to pigeon poop, and in fact, it was the radiation left over from the cosmic creation event. But the papers are published side by side where, and what's interesting, look at those papers. In fact, I should have brought the journal with me. I actually own that journal. And that's another story. Yes, go ahead.
Did Dickey become a theist or a deist?
He's dead now. And as far as I know, he held an atheistic worldview throughout his whole life. He remained committed against Big Bang cosmology, even when the evidence was overwhelming. He's responsible for what's called the Bronze Dickey theory for the universe, which was an alternative to Big Bang cosmology. But even in his lifetime, there was overwhelming evidence that his model was wrong and the Big Bang model was correct. Now, in one way, Dickey did get some credit because the student that actually built this amazing receiver that could detect the radiation actually confirmed what Penzias and Wilson had discovered. They wound up naming the satellite that NASA sent up to measure the radiation with much greater precision after him. It's called the WMAP. You may have heard of that. WMAP stands for Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe Satellite. And so they gave that appropriate credit to Wilkinson, but even to this day they did not want to give credit to Dickey. So even to this day Dickey has been snubbed. Well, what Dickey explained in the article that this really was the radiation left over from the cosmic creation event. It's interesting reading the article. And this is where I admire Dickey. Here he was very committed against Big Bang cosmology, but he remained faithful to the data and said the data actually demonstrates this. And so what you see in the two papers is that Wilson and Penzias simply present the data. They offer no explanation. They just present the data. And it was Wilkinson and Dickey that explained what the data meant, which is why I thought, you know, they deserved a Nobel Prize just as much as the other two, because they actually knew what they had discovered and were able to explain exactly the significance of the discovery.
So who was it that Dickey getting the Nobel Prize?
Well, I mean, they just talked to the community. At that time, I mean, I remember Dickey came to the University of British Columbia and gave a talk where he was promoting the Bronze Dickey theory for the universe and why Big Bang cosmology was wrong in his opinion. And actually, it was a personal connection for me because I was 18 years of age, not yet a Christian, but for the first time, I had a summer job where I could make some money, paid for my tuition, and I actually had a little bit of money left over, and I could subscribe as an undergraduate to the Astrophysical Journal for only $10 a year. So I had that $10, but I needed an astronomer who was a member of the American Astronomical Society to endorse my membership. So the chairman of our physics department, who was actually a colleague of Robert Oppenheimer, went to Robert Dickey and said, "We got the student. He's heading up our astronomy club here in Vancouver. Will you allow him to become a member?" And so I'd written a paper for the undergraduate physics society on some variable stars. He looked at it and he signed his name. So here's an atheist astronomer that allowed me to get those journals. And it was the fourth issue I received after I sent that $10 in that included the paper by Robert Dickey and the one paralleling it by Penzias and Wilson.
Basically, the reason that he didn't get it, I guess, is because he just refused to accept the consequences of the conclusion.
Well, it's two reasons.
So the Nobel Prize couldn't really give him.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't want to give the Nobel Prize to somebody who didn't even believe in Big Bang cosmology, which is why they decided to name the satellite after Wilkinson and not after Dickey. Because Wilkinson did believe in Big Bang cosmology, even though his mentor did not. So, and they felt, you know, they needed to give some credit to the Princeton team, because after all, they were the ones that came up with a calculation of what the temperature should be and what the Big Bang theory would imply. So that's how, kind of how the whole story runs. But another reason is this. Very few astronomers liked Robert Dickey. So he was rather strongly disliked by many in the astronomical community. And so that was the second reason why. So it pays to make friends when you're a scientist. So, but just to move forward a little bit, there were attempts before they sent up the COBE satellite to measure this radiation. This is what they saw. Everywhere it looked the same. And this is very disturbing back in the 70s and 80s, because all these attempts to try to look at the radiation, they detected the radiation. And that map was enough to tell them what the temperature of the cosmic background radiation was. But what was disturbing was, and this is something that Robert Dickey pointed out, if it really is a Big Bang creation model, then as you look at the temperature of the cosmic background radiation, you should see cold spots that become the voids between clusters of galaxies and hot spots that become the clusters of galaxies. And if everything is the same temperature, then the Big Bang creation model has got to be wrong. And what the Bible predicts about the universe, likewise, is wrong. And what people say about the universe pointing a direction towards God has got to be wrong. And you know, I remember Dickey, he was very strong in making this point. The Big Bang model is in trouble, because we're not finding these temperature differences. Now, back in the 70s and 80s, there were astronomers who began to readjust their models of the Big Bang, because they were thinking, well, maybe we should be able to see temperature differences of about one part in 1,000. But I remember a time when they said, no, it's going to be more like one part in 10,000, and maybe even a little bit less, which kind of caused a sigh of relief, because the instruments they had could only measure temperature differences of about one part in 1,000. And so when they came up with this new model of the Big Bang, they said, oh no, you're not going to get the clusters of galaxies we see today unless the temperature differences are less than one part in 1,000. And they said it's got to be between about one part in 10,000 and one part in 100,000. But that again alarmed the engineers, because they said, how can we ever build an instrument sensitive enough to measure temperatures to five places of the decimal, especially when you're trying to measure something that's only 3 degrees above absolute zero? Well, it took literally decades before we developed the technology to be able to do that. Then we realized the only way we're going to be able to make those measurements if we have a satellite in outer space. And so now the question is, okay, we got the technology to make temperature differences that are that tiny, one part in 10,000 or one part in 100,000, but how are we ever going to get it on a satellite? So they had to miniaturize it so they could actually get it on a satellite. Well, it literally took until the 1990s before they were able to come up with the engineering design to get that kind of a sensitive instrument on a satellite small enough that they could put into orbit without causing Congress to worry about the cost. And it was in 1992 that they came up with this map. And I remember when this map was published, there was a tremendous sigh of relief within the Big Bang community because they were saying, we're not finding these temperature differences. And I remember they had this instrument that actually could make measurements to one part in 10,000, and they still didn't see any differences. And everybody was thinking, wow, maybe the Big Bang model really isn't correct. And finally, COBE went up, and it could barely detect the differences. So you can see here that they could find, yeah, a few hot spots, a few cool spots. And this instrument could actually make measurements to one part in 100,000, and they were able to see these subtle differences. And as they looked at maps of clusters of galaxies, they could see kind of a rough fit with the hot spots in the clusters of galaxies, but only a rough fit. But that was when, in fact, you'll see a number of quotes in the Crater in the Cosmos where the people, when this map was published, you've got George Smoot, who is one of the leaders of the team, saying, looking at this radiation, it's like looking at the face of God. We really are seeing the creation of the universe the way it should be if there is a cosmic creation event. Interestingly, George Smoot was not a theist, but he made those comments. Now, the actual leader of the team, John Mather, is a Presbyterian. I actually talked to him on the phone at the time, and he was a little bit disturbed about George Smoot taking all the credit, but in fact, there were literally another 1,000 scientists that were part of the team. He said, look, I don't want the credit, but I really don't like... And George was answerable to John. John was actually the leader of the team. And to this day... I won't go into that. There's a question in the back.
Dr. Roth, did the universe start out life perfectly, absolutely uniform? It would seem that it would have to be, right? So there's no imbalance of forces to allow like a black hole collapse right at the beginning.
Well, for example, if you look too early in the history of the universe, everything is going to be the same temperature. You only begin to see differences caused by the clumps of matter. So yeah, there were clumps of matter before the epoch where we actually see temperature differences, but the fact is the universe was so hot that none of the electrons were attached to any of the nuclei. There were no atoms. Everything was a plasma, where you just have bare nuclei and bare electrons running freely about. And if you heat a body up, it strips all the electrons off the atoms. And when that happens, everything becomes an amorphous globe with no temperature distinctives at all. It takes the first moment of the formation of atoms before you're actually going to be able to see the clumps of matter and the voids. So there were clumps of matter and voids before the epoch of the formation of atoms, but we weren't able to see the light that would give us the signature of that. Now, when does that happen? It happens when the universe is 375,000 years old. That's when atoms form for the first time. And when atoms form, the light will actually show you where the clumps of matter are. So what you're actually looking at here is not the beginning of the universe, but the universe when it's 375,000 years old.
But even before that time, right at the get-go, wouldn't the universe have been such a condensed state have to be absolutely uniform to avoid a black hole collapse? If it were, is there a fundamental reason why it should be?
Well, the fundamental reason why that doesn't happen is the universe is born in a state where it's already in a state of expansion. So the very beginning of space and time and matter and energy, it's already expanding.
But if it wasn't uniform, doesn't matter how you stretch it, it's going to be uniform. And if there's any imbalance of force, you're going to get a black hole collapse.
Well, that will happen if you got the four forces of physics fully separated and if you don't have an aggressive expansion built into the physics of the universe. But see, at that early moment, all four forces of physics are unified, and universe is in a state of aggressive expansion. In fact, what happened after this map was published is that there was a group at MIT that determined that probably there was an event based on this map where the universe hyper-expanded. So that was the birth of the inflationary theory. It's this map that actually led a group of physicists at MIT to say there must be an inflationary event. Why they drew that conclusion? Because you look at this map and compare it with the universe of today, we realize that the universes remain thermally connected. And for the universe to be thermally connected and 13.8 billion years of age, there has to be a hyperinflationary event in the early history of the universe to sustain that temperature connectedness. Another way they discerned that, even before this map was published, is we know that there are human beings in the universe. You can't have life in the universe unless it's thermally connected. But neither can you have life in the universe unless it's above 14 billion years old, at least advanced life. And in order to have a universe that's that young and thermally connected, there has to be a hyperinflationary event. Yes?
What do you mean by thermally connected?
What I mean by thermally connected is that there's a thermal connection between our galaxy and every other galaxy in the universe. All of space and time, the entire universe is thermally connected.
And how is it thermally connected?
It's thermally connected through the hyperinflationary event.
From its history.
Yeah, maybe you hyper-expand the universe very aggressively, very quickly, when the universe is extremely young. That will guarantee that it stays thermally connected thereafter.
If it took 380,000 years to make atoms, that's a lot of cooling.
That's a lot of cooling.
So that the beginning was really hot.
Yeah. I mean, what you're looking at here is when the universe is now cooled to a little bit less than 10,000 degrees. If the universe is more than 10,000 degrees, you won't have atoms. So this is that time when it gets cool enough that atoms begin to form. But yeah, it takes 375,000 years to cool enough to form that. But here's where it gets exciting. Even when this map was published, it said, wouldn't it be great if we could actually make measurements to better than one part in a million? Because if we can make measurements to better than one part in a million, we can measure the polarization of this radiation. And if we can measure it in two modes, that will not only give us a picture of the universe when it's 375,000 years old, it will give us a picture of the universe when it was hyperinflating. Now, that's when the universe is 1/10 billionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second old. 10^-34 seconds after the cosmic creation event. And so that became the next goal of astronomers, not just to map the universe when it's 375,000 years old, but to map it when it's about a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second old. Now, theoretically, that's as close as you can possibly get to the cosmic creation event. But hey, for all intents and purposes, you're actually watching God creating the universe, bringing it into existence. You're literally getting that close. So that became the goal of the next satellite. COBE could only measure it enough to detect that the Big Bang model was correct, in the sense that there are these temperature differences at a little smaller level than what they first thought, but they actually had the theory worked out before the satellite went up. And what was really thrilled, reason why you got people saying it's like looking at the face of God. In fact, my favorite quote is from a former professor of mine at University of Toronto. I'm trying to think of his name. Margaret and Jeffrey Burbage. Yeah, Jeffrey Burbage, another fellow like Robert Dickey, atheist to the end of his life, very much opposed to Big Bang cosmology, and was, unlike Robert Dickey, very aggressive in promoting his atheistic worldview to his students. I can recall that at the University of Toronto. But what he said when this map was published was, what bothers me about this map, it's causing all my astronomer friends to rush off and join the First Church of Christ of the Big Bang. See, unlike a lot of other astronomers, he recognized the tight connection between Big Bang cosmology and the biblical faith. So I called him on the phone. and said, can I quote you on that? And he said, well, I kind of like the quote. Yeah, you can quote me on that. So I got his quote for the book. But, you know, right away astronomers said, wouldn't it be incredible if we could actually look at the universe when it's only 10 to the minus 34 or 35 seconds old? And that was the Wilkinson microwave anisotropy probe. But in order to have a hope of measuring the polarization, which would give you that map, they needed to be able to make measurements literally to one part in a tenth of a millionth of a degree. And so 2003 is when they came up with the first data release. So you can see how much more accurate it was, right? Okay, there we got COBE, 1992. 2003, there we have the WMAP. Now, this is the WMAP with 1 year of data. But a principle in astronomy is the longer you integrate, the longer you observe, the better results you get. But it's a square root effect. If you want a factor of three improvement, you've got to observe 9 years instead of 1 year if you want that factor of three. So it reaches a point where you realize there's diminishing returns. You can get a factor of 10 if you observe for 100 years, but they decided to settle for a factor of 3. Now, I see the hands here, but what I want to show you before I answer any questions, look at the difference between 2003 and a few weeks ago. A few weeks ago, well, months ago actually, December 2012, this is the 9-year data release. And by the way, they've announced they're not going to take any more data. I mean, you know, to get a factor of 4, you have to have 16 years. And they also knew that the Planck satellite was up, and the Planck satellite is going to be able to do a much better job. And so they said, this is the last map we're going to produce. But you do literally get a factor of 3 difference. And by the way, with this fact, back in 2003, they could detect one of the polarization modes. And that told them a lot about the inflationary event, but it didn't definitively establish the inflationary event, but with 9 years of data, they were able to say, yes, we are seeing the inflation event. Yes, you're first.
Hugh, now that the Big Bang Theory is sort of pretty much completely embedded in the scientific community and thinking, do scientists still wrestle with the theological implications of it?
They do, and that's kind of where I'm leading you. There is a paper published, this paper right here, where they kind of went down that very path. So that's kind of where I'm taking you. Sorry about the long introduction, but that's where we're going. Okay. And there was a question right here. Yes.
What was the amount of radiation that these two Nobel scientists discovered? Was there a figure?
Yes. The figure was 3 degrees above absolute zero.
No.
So that's not much.
Is radiation equivalent to temperature?
Yes. Well, what they saw was a temperature from our Milky Way galaxy, and they carefully subtracted it out, and they still had 3 degrees left over. And that's where they thought maybe the pigeon poop explained the extra 3 degrees. And then they realized, nope, it's actually coming from everywhere. You know, pigeon poop doesn't come from everywhere. But the fact that this radiation was coming from everywhere told them this is cosmic in origin. And that's when they got on the phone and called Robert Dickey and said, can you tell us what this is? And he says, I know exactly what it is. And what was interesting, too, is when Robert Dickey published this paper, we recalculated the temperature. It was one of the students that said, you know, you published this back in 1948. Yes.
Wasn't the title Big Bang derogatory when it was first announced in the world?
Well, it was Fred Hoyle that came up with the term Big Bang. And he was pushing the steady state theory. And he, in derision, referred to this upstart theory as the Big Bang. So yeah, it was a term of mockery, but the term stuck. And so to this day, it's still called Big Bang, even though it was intended to be a term of mockery.
Yeah, I wanted to kind of go back to what you were saying before, but did this temperature connection you talk about throughout the universe relate to what you said a few weeks ago about that every bit of matter in the universe is necessary for advanced life to form? Is there a connection between those ideas?
Well, the connection is simply this. Yeah, you need a certain value of the matter of the universe, which is why we have to live in such an enormous universe in order for us to be here. But it also has to be a universe that's highly homogeneous and highly uniform. And that won't happen unless the universe is thermally connected. So that's kind of the link with light. Light requires uniformity and homogeneity. You're only going to get that if you've got thermal connection, and you're only going to get the thermal connection if you've got that hyperinflation event, which is why they sent up the Planck satellite, and just weeks ago they released their first map. So you can see how much better that map is than the final W map. So now we're really beginning to measure it with high precision. And by the way, this is only 15 months of data. The plan is to collect data for about a decade. So eventually we'll have a map that's three times better than this map. But with this map, they easily found both polarization modes. It proved that the universe indeed had an inflationary event. And what's really exciting is they were able to discount many inflationary models and come down with a narrower set. The goal is we continue to get data from the Planck satellite. We'll not only know that the universe had an inflationary event, and by the way, life's impossible unless you have an inflationary event. So hey, again, when you celebrate Thanksgiving, you might want to thank God for that inflationary event. But already, the data we have here tells us most likely it's not the simplest inflation model, but neither is it the most complex. It's something in between. And we're on the verge of trying to discover that. Now, before I take any more questions, I need to get to this paper, okay? Because this is something nobody expected. It tells us in Romans 8 that the entire creation is subject to the law of decay. It tells us in Jeremiah 33:25 that the laws that govern the heavens and the earth are fixed. They don't change. And, you know, there's six other places in the Bible where it talks about the laws of physics that God set up being unchanging until evil is removed. We continue to read in Romans 8. The entire creation is subject to the law of decay until the full number of people receive Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior has been reached. Now, when that number has been reached, then the problem of evil will have been taken care of. God will eliminate this universe. He's spoken into existence. He'll speak it out of existence and replace it by a brand new creation. What do we know about the new creation, Revelation 21? No decay. No death, no decay, no corruption, which means no maintenance. We go into new creation, there'll be no need for maintenance. You can create to your heart's content without any worry thing to maintain anything. You won't have to maintain your body. We'll need zero maintenance. One part of things why it says no one can think or imagine how wonderful it will be. All right. But the whole point is we need the law of decay to bring about the end of all the evil and suffering. That's kind of the core of that video series we're talking about of God Made Universe, where we step by step over 8 weeks take you through why the physics of the universe must be exactly the way it is in order to bring about the end of all evil and suffering. But for a long time, astronomers have been able to test, is the Bible true when it says the laws of physics don't change? I mean, that's an easy thing for astronomers to do. We can look at a distant galaxy and measure the laws of physics in that distant galaxy. And we can keep going back in time. In fact, we've been able to look at galaxies literally 13 billion light years away and measure the laws of physics. They measure the same as they do in the lab today. So with rather dramatic precision. In fact, I've written an article on this for our website, and you'll actually find this in my book, More Than a Theory. But since More Than a Theory was published 3 years ago, we're now able to perform this test with 100 times, or in some cases 1,000 times, better precision. So if you want the latest results, here they are. In the lab, we've been able to prove that the laws of physics don't change by any more than 4 parts in 10 to the 100 quadrillion per year. Okay, now in the lab, what they're doing is they're measuring the changes in the laws of physics over, say, a 20-year period or a 30-year period. And in the lab, we have instruments that can measure this to very high precision. Now, what's complementing that is the fact that we can look at distant galaxies and quasars. Not with the same precision, but now we're looking back 10 billion light years away, 12 billion light years away, and those measurements tell us no change in the laws of physics any greater than one part in 10 quadrillion times. But what they've not been able to do until the Planck satellite data come through is to actually test the constancy of physics, not just temporally, but spatially. I mean, the problem in astronomy is once we get away from planet Earth, we're looking at a different epoch. You look at the moon, you're seeing physics as it was 1.5 seconds ago. You look at the sun, you're seeing it as it was 8 minutes ago. You look at the Andromeda galaxy, 2.3 million years ago. So it's impossible in astronomy to pick a single epoch unless you go after the cosmic background radiation. Here you're looking at the entire sky. This is called an all-sky map. So you're looking at the entire sky visible from the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere. It's all included here. But everything on this map is the same time. The entire map is 375,000 years after the cosmic creation event, which means we have an opportunity to measure the physics of the universe across the entire geography of the universe. So only until a few weeks ago did we have the technology to test what the Bible says about the constancy of physics, not just temporally, but spatially. Jeremiah 33:25 tells us the laws of physics do not change temporally. Romans 8:18-20 tells us it doesn't change spatially. Well, we've been able to test the Jeremiah passage and prove that it's correct, that the Bible is correct in what it said, but we've never been able to test the Romans 8 context spatially until now. What we have here is a map of the cosmic background radiation that's precise enough that we can actually detect what's called the Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect. Now, the thing about astronomy is this. You know you're famous when they name an effect after you. Okay? And what these two Russian astronomers calculated decades ago is that electrons can interact with the photons of the cosmic background radiation, and you get a Thomson scattering effect. I won't go into the technical details of that. You all got smartphones. You can kind of go get a Wikipedia on Thomson scattering. But what happens is it actually has a subtle, very subtle distortion of the radiation left over from the cosmic creation event. And so what this team of European astronomers did was to actually look for this Thomson scattering, this slight distortion of the radiation. And they tried to find it in the W map. So they went back to the W map to see if they could see the distortion, and they realized the map's not good enough. It took the Planck satellite before they finally had a map that was good enough that they could actually see that very tiny distortion in the radiation. And what that told them is the laws of physics do not change over the whole spatial context of the universe. Now, it's nowhere near as impressive as the temporal test. I mean, in the temporal test, we're able to show no variation any greater than one part in 100 quadrillion. So very, very robust tests. The spatial tests were down at about the 1% level. However, we got more data coming. It won't be long before we're going to have a much better map than this. Now, with a much better map, we're going to be able to have a much more robust test. But hey, you can read the last sentence in this paper. They said, we found no spatial variability in the fine structure constant, which ties into many of the constants of physics. So for the first time, we've been able to test the biblical claim, no change in the laws of physics on the whole spatial scale of the universe, which complements the confirmation of the tests we see in Jeremiah and Genesis 3 and Revelation 20 and 21. So that was a discovery I wanted to talk to you about 2 weeks ago. And hey, I apologize for the long introduction, but I think that was kind of fun too. Yeah, go ahead.
Can you remind us what I've heard it before? Can you describe the inflationary event? It's kind of mind-boggling.
Well, it's not intuitive because you actually have a brief epoch when the universe is expanding at many thousands of times greater than the velocity of light.
And this is an unimaginably short time.
Yes, it happens between about 10 to the minus 35 seconds and 10 to the minus 33 seconds. So it doesn't last long. And what happens is during that epoch, the universe grows in size from the size of an electron to the size of a grapefruit. And so that doesn't sound like much, but look, you're doing it in an incredibly short window of time.
And electrons are pretty small.
Electrons are pretty small,
yeah.
But grapefruits aren't that big either. And you might think, well, that's not much. You're only growing it from a tiny dimension to about 4 or 5 inches, but you're doing it in about a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second, which means you have to be expanding the universe literally many thousands of times faster than the velocity of light.
I cannot imagine how anybody could predict that.
Well, how it was predicted, it was a team at MIT that said, okay, what you see happening in the Big Bang universe is the universe starts off so hot that all the forces of physics have to be unified. As the universe cools, you get the single force of physics first becoming two forces of physics, then three, and then four. Now, they were able to calculate what temperature you need for gravity to separate out from the strong electroweak force, and what temperature you need for the strong nuclear force to separate out from the electroweak force, and for the weak force to separate out from the electromagnetic force. Now, what made this unified field theory, and hence Big Bang cosmology, so well confirmed, is that thanks to the U.S. taxpayer, we were able to build particle accelerators that could duplicate the temperature of the universe when this theory told us that electromagnetism and the weak nuclear force will become a single force. And in 1971, they were able to duplicate that very thing in a particle accelerator outside of Chicago. And they've actually gone beyond that. So we can actually prove the first unification transition. And also what they notice is that when you go from, say, three forces of physics to four forces of physics, you get things called symmetry breaking, which can cause unique phenomena to take place. And to give you a lay example of this, you can take a bar magnet and be heated up, the magnetism disappears. You cool it down, the magnetism reappears. And what's happening is that the magnetic energy and the heat energy blend to become one at a high temperature. At a low temperature, they separate out. Well, likewise, the same phenomena happens with the forces of physics. But it was Alan Guth, who at MIT, who calculated when the strong nuclear force separates out from the electroweak force, you're going to get a hyperinflation event as a result of the symmetry breaking. So it was theoretical physics that basically came up with this prediction. And then they began to predict, well, what would the universe look like if you have different kinds of symmetry breaking, which is exactly the goal of the Planck satellite, to be able to nail down exactly what the symmetry breaking is looking like, what the inflation event is going to look like, and to what degree. And what excites me as a Christian, I think the more we explore this, we're going to find design evidence we've never been able to see before. And that's kind of the principle you see in these creation texts we've been studying, especially Job and Psalms. The more you study the book of nature, the more you're going to see the handiwork of God. So there's handiwork of God we can't yet see because we don't have the data, but it's soon coming. All you got to do is wait another 9 years, and we're going to have a much more powerful case for the Christian faith. Yes?
We're now about building the James Webb Telescope, which is worth a lot, 6 or 7 kilometers of expense. What will it add to this story?
Well, what is
further in time or what?
No, it won't be able to go further back in time. I mean, these are the only instruments that let us look at the very act of creation. So here we're actually seeing the very beginning of the universe. The main hope of the James Webb telescope is that it'll have this sensitivity that we can actually see the very first stars. Right now, we don't have the telescope power to see the first stars. The James Webb will have that power. And it'd be great to be able to see how well our different models of Big Bang creation predict what those first stars will look like. I mean, if you look in the scientific literature, you've got some saying the first stars are going to be more than 100 times the mass of our star, the Sun. Some are saying 300 times the mass of our star, the Sun. Others are saying, no, it's going to be between about 30 and 60 times the mass of our star, the Sun. Well, until we have the James Webb telescope in place, we're not going to know who got it right. And we know who got it right. It's going to give us a far more detailed model for cosmic creation than we have today. And so that's why they're thinking it's worth the price of four B-1 bombers or four B-2 bombers. We'll see. It is, does rank as the most expensive telescope ever put up. Well, it was supposed to be up years ago. It kept being delayed because of funding, but they're hoping to get it up next year. We'll see. Where are they going to launch it? It's an American project. It's NASA. So probably from Cape Kennedy, I'm guessing. But it may be launched. I don't know where they're going to launch it. There's several different places where they could launch it. So.
Way over budget.
Yes.
Without being too mathematical, if possible, could you elucidate why you stick with 10 dimensions rather than 11 or 12, like this Iran one others?
Well, there used to be a Caltech physicist that regularly attended this class. I'm trying to think of his name. It'll come to me soon. But he was actually a member of John Schwartz's team at Caltech. He was a graduate student with him. And they were the ones that first discovered you cannot have a universe with both quantum mechanics, gravity, and relativity if all you got is length, width, height, and time. We need more dimensions. What they discovered is that the symmetries demanded by quantum mechanics and gravity, for example, can't possibly fit into just three dimensions of space. There's got to be more dimensions of space. It took the team almost 20 years to figure out the correct dimensional frame. There was a time when they thought it was somewhere between 8 and 26 total dimensions of space. My book Beyond the Cosmos tells a story of how they figured out it was 9 dimensions of space. 3 big ones and 6 tiny ones. And this actually goes right back to the symmetry breaking we were talking about when gravity separates out from the strong electroweak force. That happens when the universe is only 10 to the minus 43 seconds old. It's called the Planck era. And what happens in the Planck era is that these 9 dimensions of space that rapidly expand from the cosmic creation event, the symmetry breaking causes 6 of those 9 dimensions to stop expanding. So they still exist today, but the 6 tiny ones are no bigger than what they were when the universe was 10 to the minus 43 seconds old. You say, well, how big is that? Well, it's about 10 to the 20 times smaller than the diameter of an electron, which explains why we don't notice them. Okay, they're just too tiny for us to be able. I mean, they don't even factor into quantum mechanics today. But they're crucial to get the universe that we need today. They're crucial to have a universe with both quantum mechanics and gravity, and we need both to have life. Now, what we do know is if you go up a dimension or down a dimension, then it destroys the compatibility of gravity, quantum mechanics, and relativity. It's got to be 9 dimensions of space. It can't be 8. It can't be 10. It can't be 11. Now, where you do see people speculating about extra dimensions of space is in the context that maybe there's more than one universe. But our universe has got to be 9 dimensions, no more, no less. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. Now, a lot of people make the mistake of thinking that that means that some string theory model is correct. Well, there's a lot of string models out there, and they all fit into the 9 dimensions, but they're not the only models that fit into the 9 dimensions. So if we ever come to the point where we can disprove string theory, it does not disprove the 9 dimensions. In fact, relativity can only happen if you've got those 9 dimensions. Interestingly enough, it's because of those 9 dimensions that if there was no Einstein, we'd have relativity. One of the proofs that this 9-dimensional model must be right, it produces all of the equations of special and general relativity as a pure byproduct. That just falls right out. So yeah, it was nice that Einstein figured it out 100 years ago, but the truth is we'd have it all today if Einstein never came up with it.
I think I heard it's the most consistent with future coming quantum gravity.
Well, yeah. I mean, if quantum mechanics and gravity coexist, then that means even when the universe is extremely hot and extremely dense, they must still coexist. And we'd like to be able to understand that, but we won't have the observations to do that. I mean, we can't build. I mean, the polarization will get you down to 10 to the minus 34 seconds, but it won't get you to 10 to the minus 43. Now, it was Alan Guth who said, if we want to get past 10 to the minus 34 seconds to see what the universe is like, we're going to need a particle accelerator more than 40 trillion miles long. And he said, that won't be funded until the Democrats control both houses of the Congress. All right, there's a question over here.
No more questions.
No more questions? We're out of time.
But on this topic, you can't discuss this topic without discussing, just quickly quoting two Bible verses. Obviously, the Bible is the only ancient holy book that declares that time had a beginning. It's also the only ancient holy book to declare that we live in an expanding universe. We quote those two verses and then close with prayer because they're just so important Bible verses.
Well, they are.
Not to my non-believers. They just shake their head because it's like, you got me, obviously. And just, you know, how could these prophets thousands of years ago get those two facts so correct?
If I go back to my teenage years and I was reading the Bible for the first time, that's one thing I noticed. The Bible speaks about a space-time beginning. Hinduism and Buddhism talk about space and time eternally existing. And so this is what was unique about the Bible. Instead of speaking about God creating within space and time, it says that God creates space and time when he creates the universe. And so while I was a teenager, that was the same time that physicists in Britain were developing the first of the space-time theorems that prove that what the Bible says is actually true, that there is a beginning of space and time. The creation of the universe is the creation of space and time itself. Where does the Bible say this? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. In the Old Testament, there is no word for universe. Instead, you got this phrase, the Shemayana rest. And when you have the definite articles attached to it, it only refers to the totality of physical reality. Nine times it shows up in the Old Testament. Always refers to everything we can possibly detect, matter, energy, space, and time. Hebrews 11:3, the universe that we can detect did not come from that which we can detect. And then Paul says in Titus 1:2 that the grace of God that we now that's Titus 2 Timothy 2:9 says the grace of God that we now experience was put into effect before the beginning of time. Titus 1:2, the hope we share in Jesus Christ was given to us before the beginning of time. So it's making the point that before the universe existed, God was doing things. He was temporally active, which tells me that there's more to temporality than just cosmic time. Cosmic time is one time dimension that can't be stopped or reversed. But from God's perspective, there's more to time than just cosmic time. And that's kind of the promise of the new creation. We're going to be experiencing temporality, a new creation, very different than cosmic time, which is going to make possible a level of relationship that's unthinkable right now. It's something I do when I do a wedding. As I explain, hey, right now we're constrained. I don't really do this, but we're constrained to linear time. I do that when I'm counseling the couple before we go through the marriage ceremony, but how we're constrained in linear time. That can't be stopped or reversed, which is why to experience the intimacy that God wants us to experience in human relationships, it's crucial we commit ourselves to one person and say no to every human being on the face of the earth. But notice in the new creation, there's no families, there's no marriages, there's no need for it, because no longer will we be constrained to linear time that can't be stopped or reversed. Why are we restrained today? It's crucial as a tool in God's hands to eliminate all evil and suffering. But when evil or suffering are gone, there's no longer a need to force us into strictly linear relationships. So our relationships in the new creation will be geometric. Exactly how? There's a lot of different ways God could do it. That's speculation. Part of what you see in 1 Corinthians 2:9, no one can think or imagine what it's going to be like or how wonderful and great it will be. But hey, it's going to be far greater than the very best marriage that ever existed on the face of the earth, even before sin entered the world. With that, let me pray. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for the special privilege of being alive at the beginning of the 21st century. Yes, we no longer have the advantage of being exposed to nature the way generations before us were, having that intimate contact with all the creatures of life that you created. But we are in a high-tech context where we're seeing discoveries being made that really reveal who you are what you're doing and why you're doing it. Not just your majesty and power, but your great love for us as individual human beings. So, Father, I pray that you continue to make us eager to read and study both your book of Scripture and your book of nature. See how they fit together and see how they reveal why we're here on earth, what our purpose is, what our individual purpose is, so that, Lord, we can be actively involved and fulfilling the completion of the Great Commission, so that we can leave this creation and enter the far better creation. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.